911, what's your emergency?
Yeah, they're playing music way too loud at this tsunami vigil.
I'm sorry, ma'am. What's the emergency?
It's Ed Sheeran.
We are dispatching the Navy SEALs.
Think about it. If Buck had not gotten onto the firefighter path, he could have been one of those Navy SEALs dispatched.
To fight the great crime of Ed Sheeran. I agree.
Yeah.
Maybe that would have been even more of a noble path for him than
yeah, like I'm not crazy about the military, but if it were deployed against that international enemy, Ed Sheeran, I would have to hand them that one.
Singer-songwriters quaking in their boots. Gracie Abrams hangs up the guitar.
Ooh.
Imagine
she's American,
Dragons
though,
collapses.
So they might not go after her.
Imagine Dragons is Canadian, I hear. So
oh, really?
Maybe they would be. That's what I heard. But maybe I'm just putting that together because I remember in one episode of Degrassi, Maya was trying to get Imagine Dragons tickets, and so I just have the association.
That's so embarrassing. That's so Maya that would be her music taste.
Oh, well, in another episode, she also wanted to get Ed Sheeran tickets.
Oh my God.
So Maya. So
no
Maya.
No offense to any Ed Sheeran lovers out there. It's just like, that's not for me.
Anyways, welcome back to the First Risk Podcast, everyone.
Welcome back.
We are recording this episode hot off the heels of two major events in our personal lives. One, we launched our Patreon. Go subscribe to it to listen to us talk about the cinematic masterpiece that is the Ryan Guzman star vehicle, The Boy Next Door.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. And also, season 8 finale aired and
yes.
Everyone just collapsed and crumbled into a pile of dust.
Including us. This is our first episode we've recorded since it aired. Everybody's asking us to make our bonus episode about it, which we do want to do. We'll probably record later this week. It might even already be out by the time this episode airs. So, bottom line, like, you know, what I imagine we'll talk about in that episode. You guys were right. You told us so.
You
were
told
right.
Us
we
so.
Were wrong.
I didn't want it to be true. You guys
we
were so right.
We tried so hard to give so much benefit of the doubt to particular storylines in this season, partly because we had just suggested that the show do them, so it kind of would have looked stupid if we had said that and then been like, no, they can't kill Bobby. So we were like, okay, this is what we said. Like, let's go with it. Like, we'll hear them out. And then we did hear them out, and I have now retroactively come to the conclusion that it was not so good. You can't blame us for having, like, open, trusting hearts and wanting to give it a chance. But, you know, the cookie did crumble in the end.
We are good people, I promise. We, like, we really want, we tried, we really wanted to, you know, hear them out and go. I more than anyone, was extending so much courtesy to these showrunners. And I will be the first to say that the season 8 finale was one of the most, like, nothing burgers of an episode I think I've ever seen.
I still am a Kristen Rydell defender, and here's why. Yes, the episode, like, in the greater context of season 8 was not good, but, like, here's my metaphor, right? If someone drives a truck
So
imagine a truck.
A real life truck.
If someone drives
I've
a real life
those.
Truck into
I can see it
a
in
lake.
My mind.
If someone drives a truck into a lake and then gets out of the truck and makes another person get into the truck and tells them, okay, get us to our destination, do you blame the second person who got into the truck, or do you blame the person who drove the truck into the lake in the first place? And so my argument is, like, yes, Kristen Rydell co-wrote the finale, but is it her fault that Tim Minear made the entire season bad? I feel like we can't act like the entire season. Like, I don't know. I've seen people react to the episode like, wow, this really solidifies that Kristen Rydell is the worst. It's like, well, I feel like she did what she could with a crashing plane, you know? Like, I feel like the episode's only really bad in the sense that it fails, inevitably, it fails to tie up all of the million plot threads that were totally all over the place this season. And I blame Tim for that a lot more than I blame Kristen.
I'm surprisingly tracking the metaphor, and, like, I see where you're coming from. I don't want to completely absolve Kristen, though, or the other writer of the episode, her co-writer, Molly, because I do think that this was a shared failure among the entire writer's room. I think the blame mostly lies on Tim as the captain of the ship. He goes down with it. And my desire to lick the top of his bald head does not supersede my, like, admission that this season was pretty crap and messy. Fair. At the same time, I do stand by individual creative decisions. I still believe that the crash out over Bobby's death was embarrassing, and I was embarrassed to be surrounded by it.
Here's the thing, is like, we really did think that certain dimensions of the fandom crash out reaction to Bobby's death were extremely unfair and immature, I think. And mm-hmm. just because it has retroactively turned out to be true, like with the benefit of hindsight, yeah. that the storyline was misguided, I don't think yeah. that totally justifies, like, week by week being like, I'm going to review bomb the episode on IMDb. This show is yeah. so over, etc. And also, mm-hmm. I mean, a big part of my problem with the reaction is there was this one specific line of thought that I kept seeing where people would be like, how dare the show do this when it's my comfort show? And I just think mm-hmm. that is such a flawed thing to think, like, regardless yeah. of the quality of the storyline.
That's not
question.
The responsibility of the show. No,
no,
that's
like, the show doesn't exist to be it. Anyone's comfort show. And therefore, like, of course, anyone's allowed to be disappointed and feel however they feel. But what I don't think you can say is, like, the show did a morally bad thing by stopping being one's comfort show. So that was, like, one yeah. dimension of it that I found really annoying. But yes, unfortunately, yeah. it's like the worst people we know made a great point. And
yeah, I'm not trying to say no to the current discourse and the current discoursers. I'm trying to yes and them. Mm-hmm. Because congratulations, you guys, you were right. We're eating our humble pie. And, oh, it tastes so bad.
It does taste bad. This is, like, the worst pie I've ever eaten.
Yeah. And at the same time, you know, like, I stand by my initial reaction to that episode because I did think it was leading to something poignant. Granted, it wasn't. But I
think there were bright moments in there.
Yeah, I thought I stand Buck's by grief liking was good. I thought yeah. Athena's grief was good.
I stand by, like, liking episode 16 more than the average fan. I think that yeah. like, Bobby dying was done for stupid reasons and not perfectly executed, but I think that as an episode dealing with Athena's grief was pretty good. And I think it's mm-hmm. kind of too bad that people, like, completely turned against it because of what I thought was a pretty uncharitable read of the episode, which is that people yeah. thought it was, like, mocking fans. That is just not how it came off to me at all.
Yeah, so you used a truck metaphor. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take it one step further and take it even further outside the bounds of this conversation. I am going to use a football metaphor. Stay with me.
Bold.
Stay with
Bold
me.
Move.
Okay, we're playing for the Seahawks right now, but
I don't even know what that means.
Just because they fumbled the snap does not mean the play itself was wrong. It just means that the execution was disastrous, you know? But I thought that they had the right idea, you know what I mean? So the storyline of Bobby's death, I didn't think was misguided at all. I thought the idea of it, I mean, we pitched it ourselves, you know, and mm-hmm. I stand by it being a really good idea in theory. The problem lay in the overall execution because mm-hmm. the sort of the way they tied it up was so hollow and like nothing really. It was just like, you know, nothing at all.
I don't even think it was just like sticking the landing. I feel like, you know, again, in hindsight, I do kind of agree with people who say that like it was kind of a weird scenario to result in Bobby's death. I think it was the wrong time. I take a bit of an issue with people who are like, why did they do it so early before the end of the season? It's like, well, obviously so that they could deal with all the characters' grief. I think it would be difficult to do in any case, but I think it's probably for the best that they didn't do it like in the finale, because then all we would have is an entire summer hiatus of people theorizing that Bobby's not dead. And then when he did turn out to be dead, the crash out would be so much worse, you know? So, I mean, I feel like it was valid of them to do it a few episodes before the finale. I do think, like, when we suggested they kill off Bobby, I did not think they would do it so soon. I think it would have been wiser to do it, like, at least a season later when it feels more like Bobby has truly run his course. Like, it already kind of felt like that, but, like, I feel like it wasn't to the point where the viewer would have been expecting something like this. I think they should have done more like a going out in a blaze of glory kind of thing. That's kind of, I think when we talked about it in that one season 8 bonus episode where we quote unquote predicted this, I think that's more what we were talking about and envisioning, like a real like hero's death. And it's not that it wasn't a hero's death, but it was such a weird, bleak, kind of random, like, and you
it's
know,
like he could have
this
done
random
any call. It was so
special.
Non-specific to his story. It was so non-specific. Yes. You know?
I think if he were to die, it should have been like some epic, you know, forest fire storyline or something. Like, I think it should have been fire related because this is a firefighter show. And also, you know, his never ending trauma was fire related. And I feel like it should have involved the whole 119. Tommy shouldn't have been there. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry
Eddie
to be petty.
Eddie should have been there, not Tommy. Yeah.
I'm sorry
Eddie
to be petty
there,
and shallow.
Tommy.
But yeah, did Tommy have to be in it? And did Eddie have to be gone? Because that is, I was forgiving of the episode in the moment, but even then, that was the one part of the episode where I was like, why did we cut to Tommy's reaction?
What sway does Lou have on the showrunners? What dirt does he have on them?
I feel like Tim Maher might like have a crush on him because like why does he keep, he seems to like the character of Tommy, which is weird because he's like the only person who
it's like no one else
him.
Does, but this is his little baby bird that he needs to protect.
I'm like, man, just get him. We've already discussed our switch up on Tommy. I'm sorry if we sound petty, but like, yeah, I don't really like the guy. I don't like seeing him on the screen.
I need to see like a meme. I need to see like a meme that's like a three-way handshake. One hand is Peter Krause or Bobby Nash. One hand is the guy who decided they didn't need a condom that night. And one hand is the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. And in the center... And in the center is pulling out at the wrong time.
So what's the Peter Krause one? He pulled out of the show at the wrong time?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
But it wasn't
but he didn't
decision.
Even do that.
Okay.
But that's
the
just the only
weird
way that
thing,
works.
Speaking of which, great, great audio format meme, Ryan, first of all. Great
thank
job.
You.
The
thank
other
you.
Weird thing is like, according to all of the press around this whole thing, Peter Krause wasn't even the one who wanted to leave. Like, by all accounts, it was like nobody wanted him to leave. And Tim Minear was just like, I want to do a big crazy storyline, so I'm going to kill him off anyway. Now, people have various theories about what may have happened. Some people think it was probably just simply financially motivated, like they didn't want to have to pay him anymore, which is, could be. But I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but I am kind of compelled by the narrative some people have, which is like, did something happen behind the scenes? Because it seems so odd that he suddenly departed from the show and then like didn't do a lot of press about it. And I'm not trying to imply that like he did anything messed up. I know that's like some people have worried that maybe that's it. I want to believe that's not true. And the other cast members seem to really love him, so I hope that's not it. But it does make you wonder, like, if he had some kind of dispute with the showrunner or something, which has happened before. I saw people citing there was something that happened on, like, Criminal Minds where one of those actors got in, I think, like a physical altercation with the showrunner, and so they like wrote him out of the show.
Well, it's like the Katherine Heigl on Grey's situation, sure. Right? Like she and Shonda had, you know, their big blow up, and so Shonda wrote her out so anticlimactically. And in a kind of a humiliating way for her character too. Like, I would posit that, like, as much as I would love like the drama and like the fantasy of that, I would posit that it's probably a much more boring answer, and also a much more cynical answer that kind of paints like an even more like dire picture for the show, which is like
you
a showrunner wielding. I think it's just a showrunner wielding absolute power and seeing his actors as expendable.
Maybe.
And so, like, you know, making, you know, big story moves without, you know, consideration for them or for, you know, even just the show at large. Now, at the same time, there's a complication with that in that Krause isn't just the top billed star, the second top billed star, but he's also an executive producer. He's also an EP on the show. So you'd think that there would have to be some more like bureaucratic like conversations to happen to, you know, get him out. You know, you'd think he'd have a say in it. One assumes that like maybe they offered like a settlement with him, like, or like a little payout, like they would buy him out of his contract in order to make these moves, and he wasn't happy about it, but like, you know, he was talking about, you know, not being able to stay on the show for, you know, another 100 episodes, and so maybe like he saw this as like best case scenario for getting out of it. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, all we can do is speculate, but like for me, this like paints like a very bleak picture of just like a showrunner wielding absolute power to the detriment of the show, the performers, and the whole enterprise, right?
Yeah. I'm thinking we should get into season 3, episode 3, The Searchers, directed by Chad Lowe, brother of Rob Lowe, which you might be thinking, I don't like that that guy directed this episode, but consider the fact that he also directed Buck Bothered and Bewildered, and Confessions. God. So once again, we have a bit of an ally on our hands.
Oh my God, Rob Lowe, why did you bury the lead with your gay ally brother? Jesus.
Okay, I did look up to see if Chad Lowe is gay. He actually is not. In fact, he used to be married to Hilary Swank.
What?
There's a lot of lore in that family. The episode was written by David Fury, which, first of all, awesome name. Awesome name. And he also wrote season 3, episode 4, Triggers, so the next episode, and season 3, episode 16, The One That Got Away, which I was like remembering that episode and like not to get ahead of ourselves because obviously we'll cover it, but I was like, that is such a weird episode to me. The one where Buck meets the older version of himself, essentially, and they do like a weird, like really cringeworthy, like line of saluting firefighters to the, I don't know. I always feel like that one sticks out to me as like an odd episode in the 911 canon.
An odd duck. Even that title, it's like they're doing like the salute as he's going down like the hospital hallway, and it's like, in another life,
exactly,
I would be your girl.
I'm impressed by how much you know these lyrics, because I had forgotten them.
I know my teenage dream era Katy Perry very well.
Also, hot take, I think that that new Rihanna song from the Smurfs movie is pretty catchy.
I still haven't heard it. I'm not gonna lie.
Everybody's like clowning
it.
On it on Twitter, and like I get it that it's funny that like after all these years of like people begging her to release new music, she finally releases a song and it's for the Smurfs movie soundtrack. But I also
Rihanna
don't really...
is Smurfette.
Right. Maybe I just like have bad taste, but I feel like, which is possible, but I feel like everybody keeps talking about like, wow, what is this? This sucks. And I'll listen to it, and I'm like, okay, it's funny that the visuals are Smurfs, but like the song itself, I feel like is pretty okay.
I don't think you have bad taste. It would be like worse if you had like, if you're like, oh my God, this Tate McRae album is like really, I'm really vibing with it.
I have,
you know,
managed
like
to
that.
Avoid hearing a single note of a single Tate McRae song, and I'd like to keep it that way.
Anyways, this episode was written by Nick Fury.
This has been a very chaotic opening to our episode, but I feel like we're still just warming up. And also, this is another late night recording session, you guys. It is 11:11 p.m. where I am. Make a wish. It is 12:11 where Ryan is. So, you know, forgive us. And I also took a sleepy edible because I want to go to bed right after this. So
we are starting at a bright and early midnight for me.
Yeah.
But we begin, and LA downtown, all is devastation still. And Buck, our precious boy, is searching. He's the searcher.
You guys remember Buck.
He's a searcher, and he's searching. You've heard of him. He's searching for Christopher, the lost boy. The water levels seem to be receding. People, it's just now down to their, like, mid-shins, you know? And there's no Christopher in sight. He's you know, there's dead guys everywhere.
He's asking random people if they've seen Christopher. Mm-hmm. They have not.
And eventually, he finds Chris's glasses. Not Chris,
a bad omen.
His glasses. The worst omen, one could say. Because those glasses were ripped right off of him.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's like, oh no. Oh no. Christopher! Christopher!
Yes.
But
I will say, sorry to say something like this when it's, you know, a dark, dour moment, but Buck now has these like claw marks on his face, and they make him look so hot for some reason.
He looks so hot.
He's got this dirty, tattered, wet white t-shirt, mm-hmm. and he's got his like claw marks on his face all bloody, and it's like, whoa. It's like he just walked away from like fighting a bear or something.
Right.
You're like, tell me more.
I just want him to like throw me onto like a mossy patch of grass and like just have his way with me.
Okay.
Like that's this is a man of the wilderness.
Right.
And so after that, he finds the glasses. We get the title card. And then another flashback to 20 minutes before the wave.
I didn't think we needed another one.
Yeah, but like, you know, we are, and Lamau, this married couple is showing up to the pier, right? And they say, we're going back to where it all began. And it's like, oh,
scene of the crime.
Right.
They are at the scene of their proposal because mm-hmm. they want to sign divorce papers today. Except the guy is like clearly not wanting to get divorced and is still trying to kind of get back together with his wife, even though they're literally about to sign divorce papers. I have to say, I feel like this thing of two people actively signing divorce papers, but one person, usually the guy, is actually trying to win the girl back, is something that only happens in movies and TV. Because I feel like you're always seeing, I was just watching a movie called 9/11, which is a movie starring Charlie Sheen about 9/11. And I didn't get very far. But we start with the exact same.
Right.
Yes, it is about 9/11. And we start with the exact same scenario where, what's his name? Charlie Sheen and Gina Gershon are trying to sign divorce papers. But Charlie Sheen is like, but I still love you. We should stay married. And it's like, why? How do these characters in movies like let it get this far? If you're so opposed in your thoughts on the divorce, it's so weird.
I mean, like that's like he's Terry Schuster in that moment, and this guy is also like low key giving a little Terry Schuster tease.
True.
But like, I just know that this guy, I just know he cheated. You know what I mean?
Oh, I hate him so much. Like, we'll get into it, but
he cheated.
Watching this,
you know?
Scene, this is maybe, like, I realized on my rewatch today, this is maybe one of my most hated 911 characters of all time. He didn't really do anything that bad, but, like, he drove me up the wall. I wanted him dead in some sort of, like, Final Destination, like, brutal, nasty death, and it didn't mm-hmm. happen. So anyway... Yeah. He mentions they get on the Ferris wheel mm-hmm. and he mentions that he's waiting for some sort of sign, like he really is still trying to get back with his wife. He mentions that he's looking for some sort of sign, and then a tsunami happens, you know, the wave happens.
Before that, I just there's a little moment that like it didn't necessarily bug me, but it was kind of like it set off a little radar in my brain, because like it stops when they're at like the apex of like the Ferris wheel, like the very tippy top of it, and she's like, maybe that's your sign, and he reveals that he slipped the Ferris wheel attendant $50, the engineer, yes. $50 to stop it while they're up at the top. And I'm like, oh my God, like you're divorcing your husband and he's like trapping you on top of a Ferris wheel. Like if I was, if I was this woman, like low-key, I would have been terrified.
Yeah, that's another major red flag.
But he's looking for a sign and then a tsunami happens.
I would never forgive him. This is literally his fault. He caused this.
He took me back to the pier. He got me on the Ferris wheel. And now the tsunami is happening and he's filming it on his phone. Oh my God. Like a jackass.
Why does he start filming it? I wrote in my notes, why does he start filming it? I would divorce him too. Like the wave is about to crash into, this is why I hate him so much. The wave is about to crash into them. Presumably, like you would think it's going to kill you. And he starts fucking filming it. And he like trapped you on this Ferris wheel. For some reason,
it's
even
so,
though you've made it clear
so
you're divorcing
him. Abundantly clear. He's like trying to win her back by like taking her back to like the rekindling of their marriage and their romance.
So
and
manipulative.
Like even when they're on the Ferris wheel, she brings out the papers, says it's time, and he says, oh, I forgot my pen. It's like, no, you didn't, bro. And she came equipped because she has two pens. I don't know.
She didn't have two pens. She could have just been like, okay, I'm done signing. Here's the pen. Now you sign.
Well, I've never gotten divorced, right? So like maybe there's like a bylaw in like California
legally you
where
have
like
to have
you
two
have
pens.
To use, well, maybe it's because of like forgery or something. They have to be like in different ink colors or something. I don't know. That probably doesn't make any sense, but they look like the exact same pen. she works at an office and she swiped two from like the secretary's desk or something. I don't know.
But what I meant is he literally caused this by saying, like, I want a sign. And then the universe sent him the tsunami. So, like, he is at fault for this entire thing. He, like, falls backward, hits his head, and, like, breaks some glass on the Ferris wheel cab thing. So he, like, hits his head on some broken glass. I wanted so badly for him to die in this scene, but he doesn't.
Yeah. There's not even any blood. We didn't even see him bleed, right?
Yeah.
And then like it comes back.
A big spurt of CGI blood.
It comes back from commercial, and like it seems like he's paralyzed from the neck down. Like he can't move his fingers. He can't move his legs. He's just lying on his back, and it's like a nightmare scenario.
We're gonna have to just cut off everything but the head of your body, and then he's dead.
We'll have to cut off your head. The 118 responds as we saw last time. Eddie,
what could be better
Bobby,
than this?
Hen.
Two guys in the open ocean.
They get to the wheel. A Spanish speaking gentleman says that La Bombera saved them, and Eddie translates says Fire Lady. Fire
Lady.
We're
getting like a little
them.
Flashback to the last episode or a little recap.
This is around the point in the episode. This is around the point in the episode where I had to turn the subtitles off because for some reason on Hulu, they were weirdly desynced in a way that is unusual for the show. Very sloppy. And so I just turned them off. So if I miss any like important lines of dialogue, just know it's the captioner's fault. It's not mine.
I didn't notice that, but I do have a couple things to say about the captions in this episode, so we'll get there.
This this dude on one of the little, what do you call those things on Ferris wheels? Like the little
I have no idea.
Seats, I guess. But it's like an alcove. It's like a little canopy.
Yeah, I wrote in my notes, I called them a cab in my notes, because that's sort of like what they are. Like the cab of a carriage or something.
This one gentleman is panicking. He's refusing to leave. And so Lena and Eddie have to like talk him down. Immediately, I was just thinking like with the day they've already had, I would hate to be a firefighter. I already have to do enough emotional management at my job as a server in a restaurant. Yeah. Like I could not deal. I do not like people enough to deal with like...
Yeah.
Them going through the worst experiences of their lives. I couldn't deal with it. I couldn't.
Yeah.
I don't have the passion for saving lives.
Towards the end of a shift, I get to the point in the deli where I'm like, if one more person asks me for a smoothie, I'm going to murder them and then myself. And it's like, I could not be like saving people from car accidents.
Bosco and Diaz begin. This is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Letty moment.
Letty moment. Dasko, they get the guy out, and they hoist themselves up to the tip top of the Ferris wheel, where you know, murder man and, you know, victim girl are, you know, dealing with his paralysis.
We hear that Lena has been separated from her team on the 136. Mm-hmm. Of course, they were the fire station that was on the pier when it hit. And we also have like this annoying little moment where Lena clocks that Eddie was in the army and she's like, yeah, my captain served. I just kind of hate this like weird specific type of like army banter that exists mm-hmm. on TV like this, where it'll be like, oh yeah, he was in the army. Must have been a good, he must be a good man. It's like, why are we like sucking off the army all of a sudden? I don't know. That's how I feel about it.
Well, what I felt about it was that, like, you know, she mentions that like she clocked that Eddie was in the army because of the way that he carries himself. She says, oh, you all carry yourself in the same way. I'm like, mm-hmm. what does that mean? Because there's nothing in Ryan's performance.
They're all
no
gay
shade.
Single dads.
There's nothing in Ryan's performance that like, you know, like portrays a sense of like military might or pride or anything like that. He
it's
doesn't
clearly
carry
just
himself
a
any
line it's on just, the show it, that is supposed to
it's just writer yeah. clairvoyance, you know. She got yeah. touched by an angel and they said that guy was in the army, make a joke right. about it.
But eventually Bobby calls in a helicopter to rescue divorce mm-hmm. guy because they can't really get him down in a good way just with boats. Yeah. And I'm so traumatized from season 8 that when the helicopter showed up, I thought fucking Tommy was gonna be in it. There was like a small part of me that was like, oh boy, there must be like a Tommy cameo in this episode that I forgot about.
You got Tommy Kennard, I got Daenerys Targaryen. Was like, I just finished my Game of Thrones rewatch, and so I was just
you
like, oh my god.
She was gonna be in the helicopter?
They're north of the wall, and she's riding in on her dragon to save them.
Now,
right.
why would she do that in the middle of Los Angeles, Ryan?
Well, because she's trying to take Los Angeles, obviously. They roll up with the chopper. They get the chopper. I can't do it. Then it turns out he's getting his feeling back. It was just like a bruise. There was some swelling.
He was just being dramatic because he's a fucking douchebag.
Exactly.
It was probably just, he probably had total feeling in his arms and legs, but it was like one more manipulation tactic to try and get his wife to take pity on him and get back together with him. I hate this guy. I wish he would fall into a meat grinder.
This is like the end game of like, you know, that like mindset that's like whenever a YouTuber cries in an apology, they're doing it to manipulate you. This guy lost feeling in his entire body and he was just doing that to manipulate his girlfriend.
I think his body language said that he was fake. Ryan. Yeah, he finally decides to sign the divorce papers. And it's like, this is what it took, you little bitch. He's like, we were always a disaster, baby. And then he says, but what a beautiful disaster we were. And if I didn't already want him to fall into a volcano, that line made me, you know, want him to, again, Final Destination, like that guy in the third one who's like at the gym. And he the cords of the like weight machine break, and as mm-hmm. he like lets it go, the two giant weights just like
ripped.
Just like smash his head into a pulp. I would love it if that could happen to this guy in this scene.
That would be amazing. They should just drop him into the water, honestly. But like I was confused. I was confused by that line. Oh, and then make him be eaten by piranhas. Yes.
Mm.
This is okay. Piranha 3D. Thank you.
Yes.
I was confused by that line because I'm like, is that supposed to be the theme?
I don't think so. I think it's just a stupid, like they're trying to be poignant for this stupid couple, this poor woman.
Right. This stupid couple we don't care about in this nightmare scenario. And but then, you know, urgency because the debris is coming. The debris is coming and it's going to knock the Ferris wheel down.
Yeah, however that works. So
this moment was so campy to me. I was
really
enjoying
this. The debris
is
like a shark moving through the water. Eddie and Lena decide to free fall from the Ferris wheel into the water, and they manage to make it back onto the boats, and you know, the Ferris wheel tips over.
I would have loved it if Eddie like decided to be super extra and like was like, I was champion of my high school diving team, and like it hits like it's just a crazy like high dive. And it's like, and that's
turns into like and Esther Williams.
And that's on Baby Girl. Right,
listen,
exactly.
I would love it if that had happened. I love revealing more and more like weird artistic talents that Eddie has.
Yeah, this is his ballroom skills coming out. Maybe he just exactly. was like a skater growing up and he's like, let me hit this wicked 360 on the way down. But no, Bobby picks them up, fishes them out of the water, they make it out of the debris path, and then like back on dry land, Bosco is like insisting that she stick around and look for her captain because the rest of her team is accounted for except for her mm-hmm. beloved captain.
Specifically, at one point, just to be clear, Bobby says, mm-hmm. our team is still stuck on the other side.
Ah, yes, and they are. Bosco, it's revealed that, you know, she says she has like a bruised rib because she's like wincing yeah. and stuff. They're like, why are you standing like that? And Eddie goes to inspect her as the medic that he is. Turns out it's not bruised, it's broken. He has to take her to the hospital, right?
Well, first there's a little bit of like friction between Eddie and Lena where, you know, she doesn't want to get checked out. She wants to just keep going. And mm-hmm. I feel like we should address the elephant in the room, which is that this whole episode seems like it's setting up like the beginning of an Eddie-Lena Bosco romance. Even yeah, though the 100%. Show never really goes there. And I actually, my hot take is that I actually think it's like decently effective as Eddie's romances
yeah.
go. Like,
I would have
Ronda
liked
Rousey
them
isn't
together.
The greatest.
They're cute.
I know,
you know.
Ronda Rousey isn't like the greatest actor, but I think that mm-hmm. that all of the moments between them in this episode like kind of work. Like, they're kind of well written.
Yeah. I actually liked her being Eddie's foil, like in this like yeah. duo. I thought that was like a fun little way to shake him up a little bit. Because,
yeah, and I feel like nobody ever talks about her. Like, I don't really have a sense of whether the fandom, mm-hmm. like, hates or loves her. I assume it leans more towards
Same.
Hate because they hate any woman who touches one of their special little boys. But I actually am, like, a Lena Bosco truther. I feel like if they were going to make yeah. Eddie... My thing has always been, if they were going to make Eddie straight, I always felt like maybe they should have committed to the Lena Bosco thing early on, but they never actually do the romance. And then she's like off the show after like six episodes. So I don't really get yeah. what their intentions were here.
Yeah. It's a shame. Like I said, I like the foil and I think she's a good addition to the ensemble. But yes, yeah, so they sent her home like George Santos. Bobby specifically asks Eddie to
escort her to the VA hospital, essentially, because he suspects mm-hmm. that she's going to try and go off on her own to find her captain. So he's like, stay with her, Eddie. And so that's where Eddie and Lena are headed.
Before they go, Eddie tries to make a little phone call to Buck to check up on Chris, see how they're doing.
He's like, sorry, Lena, I just have to call my wife.
He makes a tragically heartbreaking, like, voicemail.
Tragically heartbreaking.
It is. It's tragically heartbreaking.
Tragic, even.
I would agree. To Buck, just saying, you know, it's crazy down here. You know, you guys must be happy you missed it. Hope you're having fun. Hope you're having a good day. And it's like, Buck is having, dare I say, his hashtag worst day ever.
I think you would be correct in calling it his hashtag worst day ever. I, at this point, was like, okay, what is the scale of this tsunami? Like, is it feasible that this much of downtown LA would be completely destroyed and underwater, but wherever Buck's loft is, / the area where Eddie thought Buck intended to take Christopher, would be totally out of harm's way? Like, I just don't really get it.
Yeah, I mean, LA is a big city. Right.
Yeah,
so like,
but, like,
I understand like if he's living away from the beach. But yeah, it's a tsunami and it's like it's a not an unsizable tsunami either. Like it was pretty big. It destroyed the whole marina.
5,000 casualties to start.
To start. It's like one of the deadliest tsunamis in American history, seemingly. And
I would think perhaps the only have there been like serious tsunamis in the U.S. I mean, probably in like Hawaii.
I was like guessing,
so,
like, if you count,
I speak so confidently
Hawaii or
about
Alaska.
Things I know nothing about sometimes.
Maybe, I mean, well, I guess Katrina, if you count that, but that's a hurricane.
But that's not a tsunami.
So this is coming from walking tour, city of Crescent City, California. It started with mm-hmm. a 9.2 magnitude earthquake in Alaska that sent tsunami waves surging towards Crescent City. In less than 5 hours, Three smaller waves pushed into storefronts and businesses. Then the big wave, cresting at nearly 21 feet, slammed into the downtown, devastating 29 city blocks and killing, wait for it, 11 people.
I knew that was coming. See, I'm telling you, we just don't get a lot of tsunamis.
No,
and
we
I
don't.
Think when we do, I don't know, we're like not densely populated enough for it to be that deadly. And so I'm saying, like, for a tsunami of this scale, if that were to happen in LA, downtown LA, I feel like no one would be safe. Like, I don't know. I feel like the 5,000 bodies, if I were Eddie, I would not be assuming that Buck and Christopher would find. But whatever, this is not that productive of a conversation.
Well, no, it is productive because it's the writers, like, being stupid.
It just seems odd that, like, they're presenting on the one hand, like, the what looks like the worst disaster in the city's history. And on the other hand, everybody's like, so glad Buck is at his house, like, 3 miles away, perfectly dry and safe.
It's like here in LA, we have 9/11 times 100, right? And the fault is of an actual fault line. And, you know, Eddie's just here like, oh, yeah, hope you guys are having fun at, like, you know, the park.
Yeah, hope you're having fun at the movie theater.
As if this is a thing that happens in LA at all, right?
Well, yes. Buck is roaming the streets again, of course, in contrast to what Eddie was just saying to him. And he hears some people saying that, like, there's a kid buried under some debris. So he, like, rushes over, assumes it's Christopher. They get the debris off. It's not Christopher. Mm-hmm. It's just, like, some random girl.
just some random girl. Like, who
this
cares?
This is not the child in the tsunami that I cared about. Get out of here.
I wouldn't have even saved her if I knew it wasn't Chris. Like, that's a waste of time.
Imagine.
And the minutes are counting down. Like,
I'm like, oh, fuck you. I didn't want you.
But the most California surfer dude you've ever seen in your life directs Buck to a like a cupcake / bakery. Like,
a cupcakery.
And a cupcakery, where Chris was apparently traveling with a group. So he seems to have definitively seen Chris, a little 8-year-old, you know, with sandy brown hair and cerebral palsy, you know, traveling with a group to the cupcakery. Points Buck in that direction.
Not a bad place to go during a tsunami.
Not a bad place. You know, if you're going to loot some place, the cupcakery would be a good place to start. It reminds me of when the big riots were happening in Seattle, and you saw that news footage of the woman walking away with, like, a full cheesecake she looted from the Cheesecake Factory.
They're looting the cupcakery. The cupcakery has fallen.
Oh, looting. Another very frustrating thing that happens, like, that
we'll
comes up
there.
This episode. Yes, Maddie, we go to Maddie, the other Buckley,
She's mothering. Back
on the phone. She is mothering so hard. She is doing medical triage for everyone there as the resident nurse, as the resident person with medical expertise. Meanwhile, she gets a caller from Kenosha, Wisconsin, famous for being one of the cities that was represented by the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League back in the 1940s.
Okay.
That's true. It was Kenosha, Rockford, Racine, and South Bend. League of their own girlies.
Lived in Racine.
You know. Oh, did she really? Oh, shit. Did she play for them? Or...
She moved around a lot to a bunch of places in Wisconsin when she was little because her dad was a minister. And Racine, I think, was one of the main places she grew up. I'm probably getting this all wrong. And then she's going to listen eventually and be like, you don't even know anything about me.
I love that your mom listens to this podcast. My dad does not listen to this podcast. Well, yes, Maddie gets this call from a woman in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and is understandably like, how did you get put through to me? I'm in LA. And she's like, no, I'm calling for my daughter. She lives in LA, and I can't get in touch with her. She was, she started texting me, like, you know, she started keyboard slamming. You know, we've all been on Twitter. And, you know, they were apparently safe on, like, the lounge of their apartment building. Or, like, whatever. She was in her apartment building at Ocean Plaza, right? And suddenly, she was texting after the tsunami hit, and then suddenly she went silent. Maddie looks up this this place on Ocean Plaza. She talks to Linda. Linda says that there were some gay boys that tried to contact each other from the same plaza, but
she doesn't refer to them like that.
But it's true.
Imagine if she randomly was just really out of pocket about it. Yeah, these gay boys called me earlier.
These fags. There's no, but then you know, Maddie looks into it. And there's no mentions of, like, you know, like, safe reporting from Ocean Plaza. I'm safe at Ocean Plaza on Facebook. Right. Designated safe during the L.A. tsunami. Remember
Nobody
that?
Nobody cares, girl.
Right? So she brings it to Sue because she's got a hunch. A classic Maddie Buckley hunch. And Sue, like, has to, like, have a conversation with her. She's like, you want me to dispatch our overworked, like, rescue force to the one place in the city that no one is calling for rescue from. Mm-hmm. Maddie's like, yes, I have a hunch. I should be a detective. I'm Batman.
Which, honestly, she should, like, and she
girl,
is.
And she's like, girl, go home, right?
Yeah, no, she has a great funny line where she says, please don't take offense, but are you okay? Which is so much more brutal to say, please don't take offense at the beginning.
But then we sort of cut from that to Drone Girl, right? Drone Girl from the opening of the last episode that we haven't seen in a solid hour of runtime. And she is flying her drone over the, swamped streets of L.A. I mean, swamped very literally. Swamped streets of L.A. Looking for Reggie, the guy who was drawing her. Her friend, the artist. And she finds another gay boy, presumably.
We don't know atop, this.
Yes, I do. He's wearing a Speedo. He's atop a palm tree with flippers and snorkeling gear.
it's such a funny image.
Unresponsive. And so she calls 911, describes him as the Frog Man. The Frog Man. Oh,
yeah,
Diva,
really
your powers
understand.
Of description are severely lacking, right?
Yeah, I was like, what does... I was a little confused.
You know, Maddie picks up the call. She's like, hey, girl, can you be specific? And she's like, can I just, like, send you, like, a live feed? And she's like, yeah. And then she types on her keyboard, goes, I'm in.
And
she sees...
like she's hacking the mainframe.
Right. And there's, like, a laughing skull virus she's uploading. And then she sees, oh... gay boy in a Speedo and flippers on a palm tree. Let's dispatch some firefighters.
I will say, I was very impressed how fast Maddie, like, just figured out how to receive and open a live stream link to a drone feed.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
I was like, I get that they made it really quick for the show, but, like, I feel like any real life, like, Gen X person would, like, get the, you know, Gen X, like, random dispatcher would be like, okay, wait, are you gonna text it to me? Like, let me, like, figure out how am I gonna get my text on my computer?
But Maddie is able to dispatch responders, of course, and they get there, they get the guy, and she thanks Charlotte for being so tech savvy, and... then brings her on to be her eyes on the ground. She said, Charlotte, there's a way that we can help each other.
And she mentions to Maddie at one point, you're like Big Brother's big sister, which I thought was very apt because
very
Maddie
apt.
Is the big sister to an extremely big brother.
Very true. He wasn't
like
quite
he's not
as
the
big
older
yet,
brother, but he's the big brother.
Yeah, it's very funny in hindsight, especially. But I stick note of that line just because I thought it was very funny. But she flies the drone through the tunnel under Ocean Boulevard, and she gets to Ocean Plaza, and motherfuckers are passed out. Like it is like gas. It is CO2 in there. It is nasty. And so Maddie's like, all right, I got this. Thank you for your help, Diva. We go from that to a very head-scratchingly frustrating scene.
Yeah.
Athena Grant is back on duty.
Yeah, Athena is like commanding a group of officers saying, we are the first line of defense against looters. And you're like, oh, brother.
This guy stinks. Like, there's no other word for it. This makes me cringe.
This is what we are wasting city resources on right now. Like, they're not deploying cops to, like, go look for survivors or, like, administer first aid. They're just like, the really important thing we've got to do is round up people who are stealing supplies because they have no other options and throwing them in jail.
And of course, like, It's always framed as like, oh, the Apple store is under siege. These people are breaking right. the law and causing millions in damages. It's such a straw man. And it's like you can't, you know, you can't arrest the wave. So you have to arrest the people that are like desperate and, mm-hmm. you know, like stealing like food and sanitary supplies. And, mm-hmm. you know, are there some people that are taking speakers and taking advantage of the moment? Sure. You know, but don't you have bigger fish to fry than right. like catching like the person who looks at the empty Best Buy and says, well, I guess this is my opportunity to get that TV I've had my eye on. Right. Like, who cares? Who cares?
But it just seems like a very like annoying cop storyline to give Athena in this episode.
Yeah. But it serves like a utilitarian purpose because like her whole thing is we need her on the ground for a certain story beat.
Right.
And we need to get her there.
How hard would it have been to just have her like finding survive, like checking houses, looking for people who need to evacuate or whatever? No.
And less confusingly too, because there are geographic questions I have in like the follow-up to this that like it's just like this couldn't have been easier than having Athena be an actual first responder in this situation and patrolling the streets of LA looking for wounded people to help get them to safety. Like,
but
that
Ryan,
seems more in line with what happens.
They are the first line of defense against looters, meaning that they are first responders for catching people who are stealing TVs.
The Cheesecake Factory is under siege. We need to protect that. You know? Where else am I going to get a skinny Long Island iced tea? Like,
where else am I going to get skinny Baja shrimp? I don't know. I was trying mm-hmm. to think of what kind of meal they serve at Cheesecake Factory.
She like says like
50,
this like,
like 50 buffalo wings on one plate for $20.
Right. Very competitive prices. The golden sarcophagus has fallen. She dismisses like her squad by saying arrests will be made tonight. And I'm just like, Athena, shut up so hard. I want to like you so hard.
That during this horrible disaster, this is what mm-hmm. they're thinking about. It's really distracting.
Yeah, it's very distracting. It takes you out of it. But then, you know, she dismisses the group and she sees this like group of like, you know, tidal wave survivors. It's
yeah.
like two,
looking
it's like
for
four
missing
people,
family
like
members,
three, you know, older people and one child in this woman's arm. Of no importance, certainly that won't come back to anything. This unmoving large child swaddled in like a blanket. This guy is saying like I think his wife is missing or something, and Athena directs them to like the VA hospital. This woman, you know, is a Spanish speaker, so she says mucho gracias, and Athena responds okay, which I thought was very funny. It's like, if you know like three Spanish words or phrases, you probably know hola, gracias, and de nada, right? That's mm-hmm. like, hello, thank you, you're welcome. Yeah, that's certainly like
okay.
some of the very limited Spanish that I know, but she just goes, okay. Like, girl.
So Buck gets to the cupcakery. And mm-hmm. we don't see him order any cupcakes because he's too sad. Because, sorry. Because he can't find Christopher. I don't know. It's not funny. Sorry.
Yeah, he can't order any cupcakes because he's too sad.
Many such cases with Buck.
And you know, he loves his carbs. Yeah, it's a shame.
He does.
But he, you know, he's bleeding because when he was, like, you know, lifting that thing off of that stupid girl, he cut his arm. And now he's bleeding everywhere.
Well, he's on these blood thinners.
He's on blood thinners, right? And these people, like, approach him, like, are you okay? You're bleeding. Like, this like, kid, he says to him, Mister, are you okay? Like, that was, like, so, like, oh, my God. Yeah. And then Buck, like, almost collapses, right? They, like, they help him to the ground. And, like, it's, like, oh, my God, he is not gonna, like, this is nightmare, Black Hawk down, like, worst case scenario. His world is collapsing around him. Jesus Christ. It's nighttime now, too, by the way. It's fully nighttime. Chris has been gone for hours.
I have a guilty confession, which is I at this part, the teenage boy who asks him that if he's okay, there was one second when I thought it was the same guy who played Cart Cop from season 8.
Yo.
And for a moment, I was like, oh my God, was this like a... Were they playing 4D chess and they actually introduced this character in season 3?
Yo, planting and payoff.
But no, it was a different actor. I'm just face blind, maybe.
I mean, like, it is a very generic, like, no offense to this guy, but, like, it is a very generic looking guy. So, and Cart Cop is a pretty generic looking guy, too. So, I don't blame you for making that mistake.
The Cart Cop shade.
The 118, we go back to the 118. Chim, Hen, Bobby, you know the gang. The gang is somewhat here. They arrive at Ocean Boulevard and they took the tunnel. And Chim says Sword of Damocles at 12 o'clock. There is a lamppost.
I thought maybe it was a down transformer. I couldn't quite tell.
Yeah, but it's like just like this lamppost that's sparking and it's, you know, like on its like a diagonal that's been, you know, damaged by the wave. And so it's gonna Ocean Plaza is going bye-bye, right? And they get off the boat, right? And like they step
into
this
puddle. I think
they're
just
puddle.
Walking at this point.
They step into this puddle, right? And like immediately you think to yourself, is that sewage? Is that what's happening here? It's gross. It's something else. It's something else. We learn about that later. They get inside the building, gas masks on, and they discover that CO2 counts are off the charts. Right?
Yeah, carbon monoxide leak.
Yeah. And so they start like going through the building, rescuing people, as firefighters often do. This guy is like this, he's having like a delusional episode because of the CO2 poisoning, and he's like freaking out. He's like saying nonsense, spouting it off, inconsolable. And like I swear to God, after like the day that I would have had on the 118, I would have just punched this guy in the face.
I like how it's escalating.
And that's how I know that like I'm not cut out for any sort of line of duty sort of thing, like being a firefighter, because I do not have the temper or the patience for it. I really don't.
You would be the Gerard.
I would be the Gerard, honestly. Like that's like the we all like to think that we'd be like one of the noble characters,
the
like
Buck,
Hen,
the Hen
or Buck or Bobby, right?
Girl,
but instead,
you're the Gerard.
I think at best I'd be the Bosco, you know, like nobly chasing down my beloved superior, but also getting into fights with people along the way. That's
be
best
Jonah.
Case scenario
I'd
for
be
me.
Killing everybody.
Yo, I can't wait till we get to talk about Jonah. Everyone's fucked, right? Because there's this generator that, you know, got damaged by seawater and it's backing up CO2 into the building. They have to smash windows to get fresh air in there. So they start to get people out and they find the redheaded daughter of the mom in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And she is like, you know, her name's Joanna. She's slurring her words. You know, she's delirious from the dioxide, of course. And she steps into the sludge, right? It makes her uncle go cleek, and it itches. Turns out she has a cut on it. And that is when Hen notices that a gas truck is leaking gasoline into the floodwater.
Yeah, this is like a comically terrible situation.
Yeah, this is really with the down, with like the fucking the lamppost coming down. It's like, oh my god, oh my god.
Like, it's not enough for them to just have a carbon monoxide leak. They also need to be like about to explode.
And who do we cut back to but Athena Grant looking for looters? The most important job in the city.
She's doing such important work. Ugh. She could be like, figuring something out for the carbon monoxide call, but no. This is where our resources are best used.
Your taxpayer money at work. Then she's in like a suburban neighborhood for some ungodly reason. And it seems like there's a robbery going on at a house. This isn't looting. It's a robbery. Those are different crimes. But she catches these guys who have this box that appears to be like filled with speakers, like really high end speakers. Mm-hmm. Taking it out of a house, they're like hushed whispering to each other about like, we need to, you know, we're already loaded up, but we have two more houses to hit on this block or whatever. And she stops them, and then the big reveal, oh, it's not speakers, it's little kitty cats.
It's
meow.
Kitty cats. Yeah, this is this weird caricature of like a type of straw man, I think. We get these guys are actually like pet rescuers who mm-hmm. go around to people's empty abandoned houses and take the pets, ostensibly so that they can reunite owners with their pets. But there's sort of an implication like, oh, this probably isn't like, I don't know, because the people aren't home to claim their pets. It's like, are these pets ever going to really get reunited with their owners? Is mm-hmm. this just an excuse to like, you know, kind of like the PETA thing of like people who will actively just like steal people's pets if they see them left outside or something?
Yeah. And like she opens up the back of their van and there's like a dog and birds. And it's like Athena, like if she was a real cop, she would have shot that dog where it sat.
Well, that was my first thought, was like, ooh, these guys are lucky that this didn't go much worse. With
I guess
the
owner's
scene.
Lucky, especially. Yeah. But this guy, he takes off his jacket and it says West LA Pet Rescue. So it seems to be like an incorporated like company that like does this sort of work. His partner in crime calls them Raiders of the Lost Barks. I love their little banter. I actually think it's very funny. It's very endearing. But like, yeah, I did put air quotes around reunite owners with their pets when I was taking my notes, because it's like, it's very unclear. I mean, these services do exist. There are several services that are dedicated to pet rescue in crises, disaster situations. And the implication seems to be that like, these are houses of people that are reported missing or dead or are hospital bound and have no way of taking care of their animals. And so this service, this pet rescue service, is there to take care of the animals in the meantime. And they're not technically breaking and entering, because a lot of people leave their back doors unlocked, they leave their windows unlocked, and that makes their job not technically like robbery. It is still trespassing. Mm-hmm. Which,
yeah,
Athena reminds
it's
them
still
of
a felony,
and to leave the rest for the ASPCA and take their haul wherever they're taking it. Says
yeah,
like I'll turn a blind
like,
eye
unrealistically
this time.
Lenient real cops yeah. would have just shown up, shot the dogs, taken the guys away.
Yeah. That's the thing, because like you think about it, and it's like, what's Athena gonna do with those animals if she has to arrest these guys? Well, she'd probably put them down like Old Yeller, if we're being realistic here. But she gives them a slap on the wrist mm-hmm. and leaves them to their little bickering. And then she hears something off in the distance mm-hmm. and goes to investigate. We don't have time to see that quite yet, though, because at the VA hospital, Eddie has arrived at his mm-hmm. final location of the episode. No, not of the episode, but of this saga, with Lena Bosco in tow. You know, he's like urging her to get medical attention, and she's just asking everyone for her captain. She sees mm-hmm. like the like a field medic has like a list of patients, and she like grabs it out of her hands and starts like investigating it.
But we get what I think is a really effective Eddie moment, you guys, where as Eddie and Lena are kind of going back and forth, Eddie notices there's a little boy over in a corner, like with his mom, and it looks like his mom is really getting treated, but he's coughing, and Eddie like watches him cough and realizes very suddenly that the boy is like dry drowning, and so he like puts him on his side and pulls out there's like a bunch of seaweed stuck in the kid's throat, and
there's like a wet leaf, it's like gross, it's like ugh. But he saves the boy
and you see Lena just be kind of awed by this, and I don't know, I was like, that was effective, like we watched Eddie actually do a thing, like he had this like kind of hot like competent medic moment, and it was also,
oh my god, remember like, that remember when Eddie did stuff like
and you know, like him genuinely doing a good thing, and like Lena is endeared by that. I don't know, it's like a real moment of showing over telling for once, which is kind of unusual in the relationship building on this show. Like, we see Eddie do an action and we see her watch him do an action, and like that moves the emotional story along, and I was just rather impressed by it.
Yeah, no, honestly, I totally agree. Like, it was like, that's part of why like the whole like idea of like a Lena Eddie romance would have worked for me, because they seem to be setting it up in a very skillful way. It doesn't, and maybe that's because they're not intentionally doing it. It's like the thing with Buddy, right?
I think, like, they must have been. They must have been just like testing the waters and then decided against it,
so to speak. Yes. So to speak. That's like a part of like what makes Buddy so great, is that it's not their words that is doing the storytelling, it's their actions. And so you see like you see that in this scene as well with Eddie and Lena. It's like, oh, the idea of the romance is justified by what the characters are doing rather than what they're saying. Now, because of that moment, Lena's not the only one who noticed. A doctor noticed and says, well, thanks, Eddie, for doing that. You're talented. Our hospital owns your ass now, so come work for us. And he's like, can I just like get changed first?
can I go to the bathroom and freshen up? Imagine if you had just finished your one job and then some random person on the street is like, wow, you're good at that, we need more hands right now, come help us. And then you have to.
I love the idea of this though, that Eddie's like, okay, I'll do it, can I just go like powder my nose, like
he needs to freshen up, take a mirror selfie, send it to Buck, who still doesn't reply, and then he gets kind of sad about it.
But we go from that lovely scene to, I really dig this scene. Like, I understand, like, they felt the need to, like, do all that to get to this part of Athena's role in the episode. But there are confusing moments for this for me, because Athena, like, in the suburbs, mind you, seemingly, she finds a dude, like, buried in this pile of, like, overturned cars, and his arm is wedged between the cars. Like, I can't stress enough how not near the coast they are.
I was also thinking that. I was like, how did he get into this situation?
Yeah, and turns out
we needed a real, like, record scratch. You're probably wondering how I got into this situation kind of moment on Captain Cooper's point of view.
Yeah, would love to see that, because, yes, this is Captain Cooper of the 136. This is Lena's captain that she has been searching for all episode. His arm is stuck, and he's nowhere near his previously reported location. And he's in a situation.
That wave was strong. It traveled far.
But didn't damage any of the surrounding houses, I guess. And also, these cars
don't
seem... It was a
very unlucky little part of the wave.
These cars don't seem to have inhabitants. Like, it wasn't like a car wreck. It's just
maybe
like
it was
these...
like the wave hit a car dealership and transported all of these cars, these brand new empty cars, onto the captain. It was just, it was an unlucky path.
It's a very sloppy, unjustified scenario, but it leads to a very fun, cool scenario, because this guy is like, you know, James Franco in that movie with his arm wedged between the two rocks. And he has to cut it off. He already tourniqueted it like a couple hours ago. The blood flow is gone. It's probably turning purple under all that blood. It's going to get necrotic soon. He's accepted his fate. And so he asks Athena, do you have a knife in your car or whatever? And she's like, all I got is a nail file. And he says, that's not going to be enough because I need you to cut off my fucking arm.
I think this has happened on Grey's Anatomy at least a couple times. And it's always good drama. You know, when in doubt, just have a character cut off another character's arm.
Remember when Callie had to take Arizona's fucking leg?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it was the beginning of the end.
We don't see her cut off the arm yet, though, because back at Ocean Boulevard, Hen is also doing triage. Two casualties so far. And things are looking bleak because they need to start walking these people out of here.
Yeah.
As they're ruminating on this, the lamp falls and starts a fire.
Luckily, that is leading it doesn't like blow up the whole place right away.
But it is leading in that direction. The trail of the flames is following to the gasoline truck. But Bobby mentioned that he sent Chim on like a side quest to go find an ambulance.
And Chobby moment.
Chobby moment. And he comes back. Chim, at this very moment, comes back not with an ambulance, but with two commandeered mail trucks.
It's awesome.
The USPS to the rescue. It is awesome.
They're kind of like responders of mail.
They are. Neither rain, nor snow, nor dark of night, nor giant crashing waves, something like that he says when he rolls up in a chimney. Always has to have a little quip, a little sassy one-liner. I was getting my life watching him roll up in his mailman chic. We go back from that. It's like it kind of like cuts between the two storylines because suddenly Athena is the looter.
And it's like, Athena, it's almost like extenuating circumstances can make people do things that might technically be illegal, but are actually both necessary and not immoral. Yeah. And it's weird that like, that's a very subtle thing in the episode, but it's also not like we see her learn a lesson about like, I guess looting isn't always like, sometimes it's understandable. It just kind of hypocritically has both things exist in the episode where she was just going after looters and now she is ironically looting for her own purposes.
Yeah, this inspires no change in her. I think we as the audience are meant to be like, yeah, looting is bad, but you go, girl.
Except like, when Athena does it. Yeah.
Break and enter into that house, steal their vodka and every like sharp object in their home, including
they're gonna get home and be so confused.
A kitchen knife, gardening shears, like she took everything. Right. She comes back to the gentleman pinned and he tells her to use the shears because the bone's already broken. So she's basically just cutting through tendons, cutting through flesh. Easy. And she says, ain't nothing easy about this. Oh, my God. This show used to have sauce.
Right.
This show used to have sauce. Athena
instead of Bobby
has to
dying, they should have had Athena have to cut off Bobby's leg.
Oh my
in
god.
Season 8.
And then you can have Bobby be all pouty and Athena's like, "Why are you so mad at me?" And he goes, "Because you took my fucking leg."
Yeah, they just redo the Callie and Arizona storyline except for Bethina, just
having
like word
straight,
for word.
Having a straight white male main character wasn't woke enough anymore, so they had to take his fucking leg. The Captain Cooper, he takes a big long swig of the vodka, says, my wife's already worried about me, ain't no time for a phone call. And so he bites down on a little bit of leather or whatever and she gets to work. And it's gruesome. Unfortunately, we don't see the details, but I would love to.
You know who this should have happened to? That fucking guy from the beginning of the episode.
Yes, dismember him.
That's like what we wanted. You know, why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people?
But back with the 118, you know, Athena's busy hacking away. So back with the 118, they load all the people into the mail trucks. I'm sure they have like a different name than just mail truck, but like I don't know what it is.
Mail trucks as in about mail, not that they're like boy trucks.
Right. As a feminist, I prefer female trucks, but they get everyone loaded in. And just as they're driving away, yo, explosion.
Explosion. It's so crazy. Wow. Like suddenly a scene out of some like action movie.
They make it out of there only to have to stop in the tracks because we're going to need a bigger truck.
Says
two
Chimmy.
Quips from Chim in like the span of like 5 minutes.
I was thinking that too.
I love this man. Love this man. And of course it's Chris's group. We don't know it's Chris yet though. Spoilers. Mm-hmm. But it is Chris's group. And so they presumably load them all into their truck as well.
Yeah. Or mm-hmm. find a way to get them there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We go back to Eddie and Lena treating people at the VA hospital. They are like trading baseball lingo. Like Eddie says something about her being a southpaw and she replies back with some kind of baseball related thing. And then, I don't know, they both played baseball, I guess.
I guess. I mean, don't get me wrong, I could see it for them, you know? I could see them like I could see them doing that like sort of intramural, like citywide softball league for all of like the cops and firefighters and ambulance drivers. You know, I could see that in their life. Yeah. They have like a field rivalry.
But Lena is really wanting to get back out there. Like, she doesn't want to rest and take care of her ribs. She just wants to keep going. Eddie sees Athena arriving with Captain Cooper, who reunites with Lena. She, as she's walking away with the stretcher, she, like, nods back at Eddie, and he nods back. Again, a good moment, I thought.
A good moment. A good moment. A good subtle moment. But then, uh-oh. Guess who else is on the scene? A very the only word I can use is disheveled. A very disheveled looking Buck Buckley.
Yeah, he's not looking so good. He's like disoriented and despondent and all those D's. And so he asks a nearby nurse about Christopher. She's like, "Oh, he's not in this tent. Maybe you should check the black tent." Which Buck is like, wait, that's the morgue. And it's like, yeah, she's implying that Christopher could be dead. So that doesn't make Buck feel any better. And he doesn't even have a cupcake to make up for it.
He doesn't have a cupcake to drown it. No carbs.
No carbs.
This is the start of his keto diet. And so Buck is despondent. We go to Maddie at dispatch. Sue checks in with her, says, that guy that you wanted me to look into, Reggie? KIA. They found his corpse floating in the water. And Maddie's like, oh, fuck. Now I have to tell my new friend that her old friend is dead. You know, he's drowned. Yeah. But before she can ruminate on that, she gets a call. She gets a call and it's her baby Buada. It's her baby Buada. And
he is not baby brother.
And he is not doing well. This scene, I will say, gives us the infamous gif that spawned 1,000 headcanons that Oliver Stark would make the best ghost face. Specifically, like, this era of Oliver Stark, where he could still feasibly pass as, like, a college student, would make the perfect ghost face in, like, an installment of the now ruined Scream franchise.
Yeah, not what I was expecting you to say, but it's true. I agree. Yeah, it's an iconic little Buck hot moment. Again, he's at his hottest when he's crying and or bloody and or dirty.
Yeah.
So he looks great in this scene, which is, it's like, it's almost like, you know, that that scene from Fleabag where it's like, she's like getting ready for a funeral and she's like, oh, I just look so good, like, oh my god, I didn't want this to happen.
I can't stop getting my hair to fall in this incredibly chic,
really
way,
flattering way.
Everyone's like, so telling you, like, you look gorgeous, by the way.
I feel like Buck is like, oh, this is so awkward, like, I'm here like trying to be super worried because my surrogate son might be dead, but I just can't stop serving so hard.
Literally. But on the phone, he confesses everything to Maddie very tearfully. Mm-hmm. He's like giving her the whole rundown. She's like, Buck, are you okay? He's like, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Christopher is gone. He vanished. He vanished into you. No. saw your face in mine.
Yeah.
oh no. Oh God. Oh fuck. Oh no. Oh shit. Oh fuck. He sees Eddie. Eddie is there.
He actually like ducks around a thing to hide from him. Like it's like, mm-hmm. you know, he's trying to ask Eddie to the middle school dance or something. It just yeah. feels like a like he's really thinks that he can hide from this situation. Buck yeah. thinks and he Maddie... needs to find Christopher before telling Eddie, but yeah. Maddie's like, that's his dad, like you need to tell him.
Yeah, like she literally like says like Evan. She calls him Evan. Mm-hmm. We get the rare Evan name drop.
That's how you know she's serious.
Big brother's big sister is home mm-hmm. and she's cracking the belt, right? you need to tell him. And then, you know, says that she's coming, like she's going to be there soon. We never get a follow up on that, by the way. We never see her visiting him in the hospital. I think because we'd gotten enough of Buck in the hospital. But as Eddie's like, you know, making his way outside and Buck's like trying to work up the nerve to peek around the corner, Chim and the rest of the 118 roll up with their mail trucks. then we get a very classic buddy scene, don't we? A very, yes. very classic buddy scene.
This is the scene that always stresses me out the most in these episodes.
It is genuinely difficult to watch because yes. Buck and Eddie lock eyes. Eddie's like, Buck? And it's like this, oh, Buck moment. Like, this is like the real moment when Buck's entire world collapses around him.
Mm-hmm.
Like his most treasured relationship is about to be destroyed. He, mm-hmm. like his surrogate son is lost to the sea. He, you know, he's lost everything. This is all his last moment.
Yeah.
And Eddie, we're getting some, I will say we get some great face acting from Eddie in this moment because uh-huh. Buck, you know, Eddie confronts him like, where's Christopher? And Buck is doing a very like piss poor, like way of like, you know, yeah. trying to find the words to explain what happened. And you
basically
see.
Basically makes it very clear from like the first word he says, at least to Eddie, that like, oh, Christopher is fucking dead.
Fucking dead. He fucking died. I was watching your son and your son fucking died.
Yeah.
And you see Eddie like piecing it together and like the rage and the grief and the anger filling him. And
it is just,
you see him like
in hindsight,
it back,
it's kind of
like
a fucking crazy scene, like an insanely yeah. devastating scene to like have in our buddy canon, not to be confused yeah. with buddy canon, but like our canon of buddy. Mm-hmm. It's
speaking
kind
of which,
wild.
Subscribe to our stretch tier buddy canon if you believe buddy canon
think,
season 9
have,
it's really gonna happen
one,
this time.
So true. I think we have one buddy canon in the buddy canon tier. Shout out
I don't have
her name which, in front of me, but shout out because that's crazy.
It needs to be said is one more than we ever thought we would get.
Yeah, it was kind of just a joke tier, so hats off to you.
As Buck is stammering his way through his explanation, Eddie's eyes pass him to this lady that we've seen pop up time and again with this large child in her arms. And immediately he clocks Christopher and runs over and mm-hmm. right past Buck and collects his son. Chris goes, Dad! It's very sweet. Chris is all mm-hmm. bright smiles still.
Yeah.
He's you can
probably
see
had
why
a great
he
day.
Was, you can see why he was inspiring to Buck. And the lady asks him, are you Buck? And he's like, no, I'm his father. I'm Eddie. And she says, he was looking for Buck. And I love this scene so much. I mm-hmm. really wish we had just gotten to like just stretch out that like all is lost moment just a little bit more. Mm. So I think there's mm-hmm. so many complicated emotions to play with in that scene. Like I mm-hmm. like I really would have loved like I'm sure there are like fix that like build it out more. So maybe I'll go searching for those after this session. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted like more of like Eddie like having this like his own grief, like all his lost moment, and really wrestling with that while trying not to, you know, pummel Buck into the ground and all that.
But Eddie
collects Buck, sort of. He has this like moment of realization that like
collects Christopher, you
know, sorry, collects Freudian slip, and realizes
he, like,
that
grabs Christopher in one hand, grabs Buck in the other hand.
My best boys, my family, and sort of realizes that like Buck was looking out for Christopher. This was a wholly unfortunate circumstance. Buck is watching this all happen. Hen, Chim, and Bobby, they find him. They're like, Buck, what the fuck are you doing here? And of course, what is a boy to do but collapse?
He just collapses because, like, he's been running on this adrenaline for so long, and then finally he has some relief. It's so good. I also think, though, it's so mom of him, you know?
Yeah.
It's like how they say moms can, like, exhibit superhuman strength and, like, lift cars to save their kids. Buck was, like, going nonstop mom adrenaline superpowers all day, and as soon 100%. As he has that relief, it, like, his body just shuts down.
Just completely gives out. And Buck collapses. All is right in the world, except for everyone that died, the 5,000 people that died at least.
Yeah, we never get a final death toll, so we can only assume that the body bag count was correct.
And then we get our favorite Ed Sheeran photograph needle drop, as we get a... I will say, I don't know if it was the music or the writing or maybe the direction of like Oliver's ADR in this scene, but like this monologue, this like wrap-up monologue, felt like uniquely corny to me, especially coming off of those intense emotions and like the very complicated and like nuanced like character study we were just getting with these two guys. It like cuts like hardcore to just like a montage of like the city of LA rebuilding to an Ed Sheeran song, and like Buck like talking in voiceover using these long-winded, overwrought like wave and ocean metaphors, these
there
water
are a lot of
aquatic
ways to be
metaphors
lost at sea. It's like, like what am I watching?
The,
yeah,
when the tide is going
schmaltz
out, you're stranded, so schmaltzy, and it's like, we get it.
I that was my whole take on this scene, was we did not need voiceover. I found myself really not wanting it at this point, and wanting it even less at the very end. Like, it was really not necessary at the end. So I did not care for this voiceover.
100%. It's like kind of a sour note for such a great episode to go out on.
Yeah,
honestly,
it leaves it on a really way less subtle note than the rest of the episode has been.
We see the Grant household. May is pulled out of her phone to come and join the family at the dinner table to play a board game, I guess, or something.
These kids today are always on their phone.
Do you think Bobby looted that board game? No.
Oh yeah,
Athena
probably
wouldn't allow
or maybe
that.
Athena grabbed it on her way back from getting the shears to cut the guy's arm off.
And she got it in the house, like, oh, something for Harry. Like,
yeah, this will be fun later once I'm done cutting this guy's arm off.
And then we see like the older couple from the yacht or the dinghy or whatever get married in the hospital. Another hospital wedding. The show loves those.
And Hen and Chimney are there as guests for some reason. Also, I just saw in my notes that I literally wrote at this point, I'm kind of not listening to whatever Buck's yapping about.
No, seriously.
So I
it's
think
like
that
unnecessary
was my reaction to it. I was just like, I realized at some point I was like missing what he was actually saying because I cared so little.
The lack of subtitles really helped that for me too, to just tune it out. We see
The thing I had to say about the subtitles is as they're like subtitling the Ed Sheeran song, they have the subtitles say Ed: and then the lyrics, and I just thought that was a
like
really
he's a,
funny way
like
to
he's
do
a,
it
like he's a character
like he's
in
a
the
character
universe of 911. I mean, I guess I agree that Ed Sheeran exists in the world of 911,
right?
Like, sure, like I guess on some level we all do, question mark, because it is the real world. But also,
oh, we
that
all
is
exist
funny
in the 911 universe.
But in the collage, we also see Bosco and her captain sort of reunite after he's presumably out of surgery for his amputation wound. Then we see Maddie and Charlie at the wall. There's this wall, like, monument to the deceased, of which there are many, in downtown LA. And there's this little bit with Reggie, and she's, like, paying respects to her friend who died. And Maddie is there with her, and Charlie says, "Thank you for being here." And she says, "Of course I am. I'm Big Brother's big sister." You know?
Yeah, she says, "I'm Big Sister. It's what I do." It was cute.
It's like, she is Big Sister, isn't she? She's like America's big sister. I love you, Maddie Buckley.
For real. She's all of our big sister.
But her big baby brother is at home drinking alone at what seems to be like 8 in the morning.
drinking
a Rona.
Alcohol?
Yeah, it's like a Rona. Oh. You know, and he's just like going through it. He's like, "Wow, I just have nothing, I guess."
He's like, "Anyone mind if a white boy speaks a little Espanol tonight?"
Literally. And who should knock on his door but another Espanol speaker? Because Eddie
Don't
has
say
once again
that.
Come by.
It feels to insensitive somehow.
It does, like, weirdly insensitive. Comes by with Christopher once again for some good at home. I guess Carla's still at the Morongo, making it big at the blackjack table.
Eddie's shown up with Christopher just like he did before the tsunami, and Buck kind of can't believe it. But Eddie is just waltzing in like nothing happened, and he's saying, like, "Here's, you know, all the stuff you need for today to take care of Christopher." He mentions that he's leaving him a bunch of Legos because Chris loves to play with Legos. And he says, "Between us, he's never built anything that really looks like anything. He just likes sticking things together." And he says that right in front of Christopher. And it's like, okay, bitch, like, who asked you? Right in front of the child's face.
Right,
like,
in front of the child.
So uncalled for. Like, let's see you build something out of Legos, Eddie.
But I will say, can we talk about how much more seemingly prepared he was this time? Like, he seems to come with all, like, the fortifications for, like, a good day at home. You know, he brought
I forgive Buck, but I'm going to be a little more careful the next time I leave Christopher at Buck's house.
He brought a morning snack, a midday snack, coloring books, Legos to stick together, and even leaves him $20 for a pizza. Like, Buck is like a nanny or a babysitter.
Yeah, teenage babysitter. Yeah,
teenage babysitter.
Because, like, the last time he just kind of deposited Chris over, right? Like, no questions asked.
Left Buck to his own devices, and we saw how that turned out. So
we
Eddie's
saw
like,
how
let's
that
give,
turned out.
Let's give it another go. Let's work it out on the remix. And, you know, Buck's like, why are you trusting me with this kid again after what happened last time? And he says, "Well, you know, Abuela, and you're half a Carla, but there's no one that I trust more with my son than you." And Buck's like,
insane thing to say
to
your best friend who's not your boyfriend
and could mean nothing.
Could mean nothing.
You know, Buck says, what if I lose him again? And Eddie's like, "Well, he's not very fast, so."
Again, so uncalled for, Eddie.
So
like,
uncalled for.
If I were Christopher, I'd be like, "What is, like, why does my dad, why is he my biggest enemy?"
Dragging me for filth right in front of my, like, other hero. And, but, like, Buck is, like, insisting that he lost him, but Eddie says that Chris explicitly remembers Buck as saving him. You know, and that's like another moment that I would have like really loved is like Eddie struggling with this, seeing Eddie struggle with like the aftermath of the tsunami, like at home, and Chris like telling him, "Buck saved me," or something like that. I don't know. I guess I didn't need it spoon fed to me.
Eddie loving Buck so much that he just already forgave him and assumed that Buck was
it's just
perfect.
Like, it's just a scene. Yes, it's just a scene that like happened off screen that I would have loved to see on screen.
Yeah.
So like I'm like grieving the loss of that scene, but I guess that's what fanfic is for. So
exactly.
I'll be reading that tonight. And then, you know, they, you know, give Chris to Carla for the night and fuck Nasty on the couch. Couch theory will never die.
Well, the way Eddie like leaves the money for pizza, and he specifically tells Buck to like eat more because he's wasting away. Which I was like, just get married already. Like, they've never been more married.
It's paying such a, attention like, to his body, like, oh my god.
Well,
oh
my I god. Mean just like the sort of like very familial, like it's mm-hmm. someone only says this kind of thing to you if they're married to you or if it's like their grandma.
And so it says like you know, you saved Chris, now it's time for Chris to save you. And it's like, oh, it's so sweet. Very they're sweet. So like they're so husbands, like buddies canon. I'm like okay, look yeah, at listen, the foundation guys. This is why you can never close on buddy, because like look at the material.
Yeah.
Look at the material. Suggests that maybe this time they go to the zoo, you know, something a little landlocked.
Inland.
As if we've never seen some shit go down at the zoo before.
Oh, that hashtag place where the guy tiger. Got eaten by a tiger last year?
Eddie thanks Buck for not giving up, and we get some closing monologue from Buck about
yeah,
whatever.
This is the point where you're like, I really could not. Like, I really didn't need this voiceover at this point, and the scene would have been more poignant without it.
Yeah. There's, like, it's also, like, it's strange because there's, like, some strange audio mixing on it. It's, like, weirdly loud. And also, Oliver's direction, specifically in this last part, is so disconnected from, like, all of the energy of the scene. So it's...
Yeah.
So it immediately you're thinking like, oh, what a bad performance, but like, oh, it's just bad ADR direction. It's like maybe like there wasn't even like a director like on the scene with him. Maybe they just did that in his house after they finished shooting, and like the ADR person was like, the director wants it like this.
Yeah, it's funny because I do remember thinking Buck's voiceover in Buck Begins is really corny, so like maybe it is true that like what if Oliver Stark is just like corny specifically in voiceover.
Yeah, he's not like he would never have a career doing like audiobooks.
Yeah.
But then the episode comes to a close.
Well, he has a line in the voiceover where he says, isn't that what we're all searching for? And remember, this episode is called the searchers.
Wow, that's deep. That's poignant. Wow.
Exactly. I mean, all in all, I will say, like, first thing I have to say, that buddy cocaine hits like nothing else. You know,
like
this
else.
Final scene, it's really a classic buddy moment. And I was just having that thing of like, I had to rewind it and watch it again.
Three lines on the firehouse dining room table. I was like obsessed with this episode for like a number of reasons, and so because of that, like, I've just been very excited to talk about it today. And I'm really satisfied with this one. I genuinely think that the tsunami arc is like the best disaster, and this is not an unpopular opinion, but it's definitely the best disaster arc they've ever done on the show. I don't think anything touches it, and don't think anything will ever touch it, especially because like they've already done so many disasters that like nothing short of like a super volcano explosion would like 2012 style would come close.
Like just the entire world flooding.
Like who's gonna be Noah rounding up all the gay boys? And so because of that, I like love this one emotionally, and also I just think like it has a lot of moments of poignance. There are individual moments that frustrate me, but overall I'm a full stop fan of this one. So with that, I hope you enjoyed our coverage of the tsunami arc. Hope it was everything you wished for. If you'd like to hear more of our ramblings, of which we had several today, go subscribe to our Patreon. Our conversation with the boy next door is getting rave reviews, so expect
Except
more
that
of
we
that.
We accidentally called Wen from Lemonade Mouth Wes from Lemonade Mouth.
I don't think that's a we thing. I think that's a you thing.
Okay. You didn't have any idea what his name was. So, oops, I can't believe I forgot, after I was like making such a big deal of like being a Lemonade Mouth fan too. So anyway, if you want to hear what that's about, you can check out our Patreon.
And with that, oh my goodness, it is almost 2 in the morning where I am, and it is almost 1 in the morning where you are. So yes. I would love for this session to end. So thank you for listening to another episode of the First Risk Podcast. Follow us on social media at First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds. And with that, we are going to wave to you a very good night.
Jokes are always best the third time around.